Hi, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast in partnership with Help Musicians. Help Musicians is a charity that's been aiding musicians for 100 years, supporting music creators of all genres across the UK. Whether it's mental health support, training or mentoring, or supporting new projects, Help Musicians have always been there to lean on, and none more so in the last year during various lockdowns. Over the coming weeks, I'll be joined by many musician friends to chat about the inspiration of making music, including the highs and the lows. In this episode, I'll be joined by the son of a milkman who grew up to become a true musical genius, who dabbled with jazz, reggae, rock, pop, classical and musical theatre. He, with Andy Summers and Stuart Copeland, toured the world. They had many platinum discs and just had an amazing time by the sound of it. He starred in Quadrophenia and worked with David Lynch. He has his own wine from his wonderful vineyard in Italy, and is the only person I know to record an album on a loop. Please welcome Sting. Well, Sting, thank you so much for coming on to my podcast. I Never Thought It Would Happen, which is a Help Musicians charity podcast.
Well, musicians are in need of help at the moment because of what we've all been through in the past almost 2 years now. So anything we can do as an act of solidarity, I think we should do.
We should indeed. So when you were a young teenager and you were at home, how did your bedroom look?
How did my bedroom look?
Yes.
My constant companion as a teenager was a guitar. I had a 6-string Spanish guitar. I was given it by an uncle who emigrated to Canada, and it only had 5 strings, rusty strings, when I first got it. But I recognised that I must have been about 8 or 9. I recognised that it was something that could help me, a friend. And I managed to save up for a set of strings. They were called black diamonds, quite expensive ones. They were made in Kalamazoo, Missouri, which I thought was incredibly romantic.
Yeah.
I've been there now. I know it's not. But I then bought a book called Jeffrey Sisley's First Steps in Guitar, which put you through the rudiments of notation and what a C chord looked like on the page. And it became my best friend, and I didn't speak for a couple of years to anybody in the family. I just played the guitar.
And do you still have it?
No, I think my brother has it, actually. He still has it under the bed.
Where all the best things are kept.
Yeah.
Did you have any posters on the wall?
I think I probably had Brigitte Bardot, who was my pin-up.
So you didn't have football players or pop stars?
No. No, I didn't.
Who were you attracted to musically at that time?
Well, I had an interesting childhood. My mum was a piano player, and she brought in Broadway shows, like West Side Story or Carousel and South Pacific, and I'd play those records to death. I just loved them. And she also brought rock and roll into the house on 78, actually. Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, this big 78s, used to play those. And then they were 45. So she was quite a musical person. And my dad sang. And when they weren't fighting, they would actually sing together. But that wasn't very often because they were usually fighting. So I sought solace on my own with a guitar, with First Steps in Guitar, and learnt the rudiments.
So did you feel quite lonely in your room playing the guitar while everybody else was singing or fighting?
No, I didn't want to join in the fighting, so I was, happy just on my own, solace. Yeah. And have been ever since, actually.
I know that feeling. When I was at school, there was a guy called Eric Stuckey, and he turned me on to a lot of music that I didn't initially like. Bands like Chicago and a band called Heaven, Canned Heat, who I didn't really understand at the time. Did you have a mate at school who did that kind of thing?
Well, I used to take my guitar in when I got to the grammar school. I used to have my guitar in class, and I sort of got a reputation of being the guy in the school who could play Davy Graham's Angie, you know, sort of finger picking. And people would come and check this out. And I befriended this older kid. I've forgotten his name now, but he was in the sixth form. And he said, "Do you ever listen to jazz?" And I said, "No." He said, "This is Thelonious Monk." He gave me an album of Thelonious Monk playing solo at the Paris Olympia. I forget which year it was. It was obviously in the 60s. But he said, "You won't like it." He says, "But if you persevere with it, you'll start to hear things that you didn't hear before," which is very similar to the situation you're talking about. So I put it on and I do my homework, and there's Thelonious Monk going through these very, very abstract, strange harmonies and weird shit. And I thought, man, okay, I'll just persevere. And after about, I'd say a week, I started to hear music instead of just discord. And I think that just opened a side of my brain up that wouldn't have been opened otherwise. You know, I believe, and I'm not a scientist, obviously, but one part of the brain can decode thirds and fifths, which is most pop music. And another side of the brain can deal with more complex harmony, like sixths or ninths or elevenths or even thirteenths, which a lot of people hear and go, "Ugh, jazz, I hate it." But it's really just opening your head to, you know, things that... Who defines what is music?
And did that influence the way that you played?
Yeah. I started to want to learn what a jazz chord was. And I'm not a jazz player by any stretch of the imagination, but I understand the language and I can communicate with jazz players who I, you know, really appreciate their ability to improvise. I don't really have that. I need to plan everything. So I'm very slow. But I understand the language. And I think that helped me. So when I first started to play with other people, it wasn't in a garage band, it wasn't in a rock band. I played with much older guys playing traditional jazz. It's called Dixieland.
Yeah.
And I played a double bass for a while. Then I was in a big band where I had to learn to read bass parts. And then I played in a mainstream jazz group. And eventually, in the early 70s, the time of Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock, this thing called jazz rock came along, which sort of got me into playing rock and roll, but with a jazzy flavour.
Yeah. I remember being in a record shop in Somerset, and Thelonious Monk was racked under The Loneliest Monk.
Yeah, who is Thelonious Monk?
Who is? I don't know. Probably me, I guess.
Isn't that a great name, Thelonious?
It's fantastic. You don't get too many of those in the pop world.
You don't. No weird names in our world.
So what was your local record shop like?
It was called Bradford's, and it was underneath the Gaumont Cinema on the High Street, which was quite close to where I lived. And Mr. Bradford was the owner of the shop, and he had no roof in his mouth. So he would speak like that. He couldn't really articulate words. But for sale were the latest singles. There was a chart from the Melody Maker on the wall. He sold guitars. I don't think he sold any amps. He had a Burns guitar, which was an English, like a Fender, an electric guitar. I thought you just plugged it into the wall. That's how stupid I was. But, I mean, it was beyond the bounds that I'd ever... gravitate to one of those. I couldn't afford it, but it was in the window. It was red and shiny with a white scratch plate, and I thought, like, wow, wouldn't it be great to own one of those? But I just stuck with an acoustic guitar for while I could. But yeah, Bradford's was a place I'd go to, and I remember buying my first Bob Dylan record there, the Freewheeling Bob Dylan, the Birds, stuff like that.
Wow. Yeah, I remember buying my first bass. It was a Bill Wyman bass.
Oh, really?
Do you remember those?
It was a big sort of...
Pear-shaped thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it had, uniquely, a bit of cloth on the back so you wouldn't get your belt scratching the back of the guitar.
That's a very, very, very good invention. Did you hold it upright like Bill?
No, I could hardly play it, to be honest. It just looked good. Were your parents supportive of your musical love?
My mum certainly was. She sent me for like music lessons down the road. There was a man called Mr. Bianchi, who was a teacher, and on Saturday mornings he would, for an hour, for like 10 bob, I think, or maybe five shillings, I'm talking about, you know, he would take me through a piece every week and say, learn that and we'll pick the bones out of it next week. So it was quite a formal education in that sense.
So the first band you were in then, they were much older chaps.
Yeah.
How was that for you? Did you sort of look up to them and aspire to what they were doing?
Well, they were probably in their 50s, and I would be, you know, 17, 18, and I just have to learn their repertoire. I didn't really know it. Looking back on it, though, it was quite similar to rock and roll. You know, you play in a triad jazz group, and it sounds like a rockabilly band sometimes. I did look up to them. They were from the first trad boom in the 50s.
Right.
And they'd carried on playing, so, yeah. They also named me.
Did they really?
That's where I got this ridiculous name. The band uniform was grey slacks, black shoes, and a pink nylon shirt, which was hideous. So I turned up one day for a gig in a striped sweater that a girlfriend of mine had knit me, which was like black and yellow hoops. And the band all guffawed and laughed, and the trombone player started to call me Sting because I looked like a bee. And that name just stuck with me. You know, they'd call up the house and say, "Is Sting there?" And my mum would go, "What?" But eventually it became my stupid name, and, you know, 50 years later, here I am.
It served you well, come on.
It's very cryptic for autographs, I'll give you that.
I'll give you that, absolutely. So did you quickly get ambitions to have your own band?
No. Not really. I would sort of join other people's bands. I was quite shy. Then I found out I could sing, and I think that was a turning point. Mm. And I had an interest in writing my own material. But I kept that back for a while. But I could sing tunes, and I'd sing in this trad jazz group. They made me sing every night a song by the New Seekers called The Never-Ending Song of Love, which, again, I loathed. But, you know, I did it because I'm a good sport, and sort of got more and more confident as a singer.
So
forgotten about that.
So that's when the songwriter appeared.
No, I think with the guitar, you know, I decided because of the Beatles that, you know, they took the world over by writing their own songs, which was unusual for a band or a pop group. You know, Tin Pan Alley would write the songs and you'd perform them. If you were Adam Faith or Cliff, you didn't write your own songs. Elvis didn't write his own songs. But with the Beatles, who came from Liverpool, obviously, and were grammar school boys like me, with a working class background, they conquered the world by writing their own songs. So I think that gave permission for the generation behind them to at least try. And, you know, all of us at that age, mm-hmm. 10 years younger than the Beatles, saw that as an opportunity, and we took it.
And what kind of songs were you writing when you first sort of dabbled?
I imagine they were pretty awful. You know, you just basically copy what you've heard and you do a sort of facsimile of what you think would be popular. But it takes a while to find a composer's voice, if you like, or a point of view even.
Sure.
That took a while.
But did you find it hugely romantic to be able to play the guitar and sing?
Yeah, I think it's a romantic idea. And also the songs I was listening to were all about love. You know, the Beatles sang about love. I knew nothing about love. I'd never been in love or even had a girlfriend. But, I that's what you sang about, you know, your broken heart or somebody who's left you or something. What I did learn early on was that the song that goes, "I love you and you love me," is a kind of closed loop and it's not that interesting. Whereas "I love you, but you love somebody else," that's really interesting because it's three-dimensional. You know, you
sure.
can walk around that and you can find a drama in that, whereas "I love you, you love me," it's done. You can't get in.
But is there a song, you know, when you're sitting on your porch and you think, well, that's the first song that I really wrote, that I own?
you know, you never really abandon anything you write. It's always there. And so you might not finish something and there might be something worth keeping. And you sometimes go back in the reservoir and find the fragment of something you'd written before and never finished that is somehow useful. Or you can add it to another fragment you found later on down the line. So I would think there are, in the DNA of my songs, there's stuff left from when I was 14.
Right.
I can't identify it, but I know it's there.
Yeah. So how did you get from that scenario of learning to write songs to a band called Last Exit?
Well, Last Exit began as was in a college I was at. I was a teacher's training college, and there was a band, a jazz group, and I finagled my way into that on bass, and then started to sing songs with them. And we ended up having a local following. We'd play local colleges and do the odd gig. And one night I was playing and singing at another teacher's training college in the west end of the city, and this American drummer turned up with a local journalist, and he was in a band called Curved Air, and Stuart Copeland. And after the show, he came up and said, "Hey, I'm Stuart Copeland," and it's obviously American. He said, "If you're ever in London, give me a call." And, my plan was actually to leave Newcastle, leave teaching, and go to London. So Stuart's was the only number I had. So a little later, I turned up in Mayfair in Green Street with his number, and I said, "I'm in the phone box outside your house." So, really? I said, "Yeah." So I went up, and it was this huge apartment, you know, a flat on the top floor. And I thought, "God, these guys are amazingly rich." I later found out it was a squat. And so there was a bass, and Stuart was there with his drum kit. His girlfriend was Sonia Christina, who was also in the house, very beautiful singer. And a guy called Henry, who was a Corsican. He looked a bit like a pirate in leather pants and sunglasses, even though it was pitch dark in this room. And we started to thrash out Stuart's three-chord songs, and that became The Police that night.
I'm pretty sure I saw Last Exit at the Nashville Rooms with Stuart.
Well, Stuart wouldn't have been in the band, but you mean with Stuart being in the audience?
Yeah, and Miles. Yeah,
that's probably true, yeah. I was still in the band, and I brought them to London, and we played the Nashville, we played the Dingwalls in Camden. So I was sort of between bands, yeah. I mean, you were there, Chris.
I was there. I think you were wearing a boiler suit, if I remember rightly.
Very unfashionable boiler suit, but, you know.
And I remember Miles saying, "You're going to form a band with you singing. You're going to be the lead singer." And I thought,
there you go.
That's going to be an amazing thing. And it was.
It was an amazing thing. Complete accident. Like most of my life.
Yeah. So you went and hung out with Stuart, and you started writing within the context of the band then? Or?
Well, it was Stuart's band to begin with, and he'd written three or four songs. And I think we supplemented that with an animal song, "We Gotta Get Out of This Place," which I really related to. You know, the animals are from Newcastle. And that idea of getting the hell out of there was definitely something that I appreciated. Our set probably lasted about 20 minutes, all told. And then I started to bring songs in, slowly. And then more and more. But I found, as much as I loved Henry, the guitar player, he couldn't really handle the stuff I was bringing in. Mm-hmm. You know, there were more complex chords than just E, A, and D.
Sure.
And it suggested that we should look for another guitar player. So that I was really the architect of Henry's doom. Having said that, he and I are still very, very, very good friends, and he was amazing. He really understood that he couldn't be in the band any longer, and you know, I was given the job of firing him because it was my idea. But thankfully, we're still friends.
Seems like every band has got somebody they eject at the beginning. We had a drummer that we had to get rid of because Muff Winwood said he couldn't keep time.
It's a problem.
It's a problem.
That's your problem, job, isn't it?
It's a problem that some drummers have, of course.
You know, I don't know whether you're crazy and you become a drummer because you're crazy, or you start drumming and then you become crazy because of the drumming. I you know, it's a chicken and the egg situation, but yeah. A band is only as good as its drummer. It's as clear as day to me. So, you know, if some a guy, early drummer in the Squeeze, couldn't keep time, I'm sure you had to get rid of him. But I've been fortunate in my career. Stuart Copeland is one of the most original, dynamic drummers in rock history, as far as I'm concerned. And then since then, I've been, you know, the best drummers in the world have been in my band. So I've been very fortunate, very.
Yeah, you had Vinny in your band, who's I love watching.
Vinny Colaiuta, Manu Katché, my current drummer, Josh Fries. I mean, they're incredible. So, yeah.
Alongside our weekly guests, in each episode, we'll be meeting other musicians from around the UK who've been supported by Help Musicians during these turbulent and troubling times during COVID. The charity has provided over 21,000 musicians with financial hardship support. These beneficiaries are singers, songwriters, composers from rock and pop and classical, and they're all here to tell their story.
Hi, I'm Sans Souci. I'm a singer-songwriter, producer, living in London. Yeah, I definitely feel like Sans Souci is a mantra for me, because when I started, I definitely wasn't that carefree about life. I feel like my name really, really helped me. And it was a nickname that my grandma gave me when I was a kid. When I was really little, I loved Maria Callas and Edith Piaf. I would listen obsessively to Beyoncé and Alicia Keys and Rihanna. They really made me feel like I had a voice in the world. And my biggest inspirations production-wise, I would definitely say are Quincy Jones and Rick Rubin. What I do at the moment is an interesting blend of R&B, pop and folk. Keeping in mind my heritage, my mother's family is from Congo, my father's family is from Italy, so there's quite a lot of cultural influences. So I would mention Lucio Battisti, that I really love and admire. And then I love Rumba Congolese. It's really lively, and guitars and bass are coming together. I love the polyrhythms, I love the melodic elements that are always really major. And I love guitar. And then from the English tradition, I would say Nick Drake is one of my biggest inspirations. So what Help Musicians did for me, which I'm really, really grateful for, the emergency fund that they put out for musicians that were struggling with pandemic, and I was able to refine my home studio. And that really changed my life, because without that recording equipment, I don't know where the music would have come from. I used some of the money from that fund to pay my co-arranger, Yaka Skapin, with whom I arranged the strings for the EP. And I paid one co-producer, Alessandro La Barbera, for one track. There's a lot of favors that you need to pull in a moment of crisis, but also when you have a chance to pay people, I think it's important to do it. There is always a way to make things work for you, as long as you know what you need and what you're looking for. It might require a lot of thinking and, you know, a lot of getting outside of your comfort zone and asking for help, people you can reach out to. But, you know, the thinking outside of the box, I think, is key in a time like this.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you, or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. What was it like moving from Newcastle to London? Were you in awe of being in London?
Yeah, it was a long way. You know, it's 300 miles, but almost a different age, you know. We're definitely out on a limb up in Newcastle. But also it gave me a sort of outsider's sense, or an engine of ambition that I wanted to break in, which is basically what appealed to me about punk. You know, that The Pistols, you know, their first album, their only album, I think, is a fantastic record. Never mind the Bollocks. And The Clash and The Damned. You know, although the music was kind of simple, I appreciated the energy, and that feeling of being outside was something I related to.
Do you remember your first trip to the States?
Oh, boy. Yeah, we got a £60 one-way ticket on Freddie Laker's Airways to New York. Just one way.
So did we.
Of course you did. You were from the same stable. You were before us. You were the template for it. And I arrived at JFK late one night, or maybe it was 7 in the evening, so it was dark, and got a cab to the Bowery. In those days, and this was 1977, I think, the Bowery was the Bowery. It was pretty heavy.
Pretty rough.
And we played... I think 2 or 3 sets at this club. Hardly anybody was there. The record company said, don't come because we can't support you. We did anyway. Maybe there were 3 people there. And then in between sets, I only had enough money for a cup of coffee and I was kind of really tired. So I went down to a place called Phoebe's, which is just down the street from CBGB's, and ordered a coffee and drank it, and then the waitress started to fill it up, and I said, no, I can't afford another cup. She said, honey, this is America. The second cup's free. And I thought, oh, this is the place for me. Yeah. I like it here.
Yeah. That's amazing. And did you have a little blue van to drive around in?
We had a station wagon.
Yeah.
It was only a 3-piece, you know, so I had a bass cabinet, and Andy had a little... either a Vox AC30, a little Fender Twin or something like that, and Stuart's drums. And we'd pick up PAs in every club. And Kim Turner was our driver, our road manager, and our sound guy. So there's basically was 4 of us, 2 motel rooms in a night. You know, Andy and I would share, and Stuart and Kim would share. And so we'd make, you know, enough for per diems every day, like $10 a day, which I saved up. So I could bring home to my wife to say that, you know, I hadn't completely wasted my time. Here's $40, love.
That's so funny. Oh, my God.
It wasn't funny at the time. It was no. Desperate.
They were long tours as well. I know we shared the same management and the same agency and stuff. In Miles Copeland's book that he's just released, he says that you and the Police and Squeeze were the band that really opened up America for a lot of other artists.
Well, we did it on a shoestring, which was, you know, Miles's idea. We didn't have massive record company backing. You know, a tour America, you'd need the record company to give you a huge advance and give you tour support. You'd usually end up supporting Foreigner or some big band, you know, and no one would want to hear you if you were supporting anybody. So we said, no, we'll headline our own tour, even if only 3 or 4 people turn up. Which is exactly what we did. Mm. And I remember one night we were in Poughkeepsie, which is north in New York State, and it was called the Last Chance Saloon. And I swear that there was tumbleweed in the alley outside. So we go in there, and it's time to go on. It's like 9 o'clock, and there are 3 people in the auditorium. There's 1 guy down the front and 2 guys way at the back. So I say, hey, okay, where are the Police? And what's your name, sir? And he gave me his name. And I said, well, this is him. And I introduced the 3 of them. I said, why don't you come down to the front? And they did. And they sat together and had a drink together. And we performed. And, you know, we did like 4 encores or something. Ridiculous. It was just an absurd situation. Anyway, those 3 guys were radio station programmers. We didn't know that. Mm. But the next day, they started to play Roxanne, which is a single. And just goes to show you, you know, with only 3 people there, you should give a show.
You got to, yeah.
Which is what we did. Mm. Of course, if you mention that gig now, everyone will say, yeah, I was there.
I was there, yeah.
What a lie.
How did you get Andy in the band?
I was working with a guy called Mike Howlett, who was in Gong.
Yikes.
Bass player in Gong. And his girlfriend was my publisher. I'd managed to get a publishing deal. And he invited me along to join a band with him with 2 basses. And that sounds a bit like Spinal Tap. But he played the bass, I played the bass. And he brought Andy Summers along, who was quite famous. He'd worked with Kevin Coyne. He'd worked with Kevin Ayers. He was Andy. In the New
wow.
Animals. Yeah.
Wow.
Andy'd had quite a career. He'd worked with Zoot Money in the early days. Andy was about like 10 years older than we were, but a very experienced player. And Stuart was in this band too. The two bass players, Stuart and Andy, that actually became the Police when I think about it. We just fired the other bass player.
You were firing a lot of people.
We were basically parasites, you know. We would see something we liked, take it, and then move on. We were pirates. Thieves.
So when we were touring and then you came over to America and you started to tour, suddenly you got a lot of traction with Roxanne and you were playing huge venues and flying in and out of one place and doing loads of massive tours. Would you say that was one of the high points of your career?
I think the beginnings of any enterprise are the most exciting. You know, when you play CBGBs and then the next time you come into town, you play the Bottom Line or you play the Palladium and then you play Shea Stadium. I mean, it seems meteoric, you know, it took a few years, but those stages were very exciting and to get to the next level was exciting. But once you'd got that, I found it was diminishing returns in terms of satisfaction in that everything we, as the band we set out to do, we achieved tenfold, hundredfold. And so me being the kind of person that I am would always look for novelty, always look for another challenge. And so that was really the seeds of the end of the Police, because we'd achieved everything we'd set out to.
Did you find yourself on stage singing Roxanne and thinking, oh no, not this again?
No, I never have that thought. My job as a singer, as a songwriter, is to sing that song, for example, which is 50 years old now, with the same passion and the same curiosity as if I'd written it this afternoon. And having that attitude towards it and other songs allows me to explore it still. I always find something incremental, a tiny little thing that no one else would notice. Ah, that's interesting. I'll try that. So songs for me are not set in stone. I'm always looking to change an arrangement, change a chord here, change the tempo, change the key, change a word. There's always something to do to keep it alive, because the song is an organic, living thing, or it should be.
Yeah. So it's like being in the theatre in a way. You have to go on stage every night, read the lines as if it's for the very first time.
Yeah. You are performing a song. You have to give it life.
Absolutely.
But the other attitude, you know, oh God, I'm bored. Yeah. Forget it.
Get
another job.
Yeah. So what were your lowest points, do you think?
Well, it's interesting, because what you would think would be the highest points in my life also coincided with the lowest. You know, the band was top of the world, and my personal life was falling apart. You know, my first marriage was falling apart. My relationship with the other guys was falling apart. And so where you would think I would be on top of the world, I was actually not, which is also one of the reasons we broke up. I wasn't a happy bunny at all. And it certainly wasn't Andy and Stuart's fault. It was probably me. But I'm a restless soul.
What was it like recording your first solo album? Was that with a guy called Pete Smith?
Yeah, Pete Smith was the engineer. I think the title solo album is misleading and it's not helpful. You know, I didn't just do it on my own. I wasn't just singing with a guitar.
No.
I had a fantastic band for that album, Branford Marcellus, again from the jazz world. Kenny Kirkland, Omar Hakim on drums, brilliant drummer from Weather Report, Daryl Jones on bass. I managed to hold the guitar seat. So that wasn't a solo album, but it was an album outside of the Police.
What is a solo album then?
I've no idea.
Right. I suppose it'd be just you playing the guitar.
I mean, it's defined by people recognising that I wasn't in the band that they'd associated me with. That's all that is.
Mm. What ambitions did you have with the police behind you?
Well, obviously I had a bit of momentum because of the success of the police, that people would be intrigued at least by whatever I did after that. And that was the case. And luckily that momentum gave me a hit album, which actually competed with the police in a sense. And so that gave me the confidence to just stay outside of the band. I think Andy and Stuart had made a tactical error. They both made solo albums. I use that term just for sake of argument. Stuart made a record, Andy made a record outside of the police. And I thought, well, I can do that. So I did.
You strike me as a very ambitious man because you do so many different things. You collaborate with lots of different people. You've recorded an album on the lute, for instance. I mean, it's just amazing. That do you get up in the morning and ever feel like you're bored?
I get restless.
Yeah.
I can't allow myself to get bored. I think I'd be depressive. So I work to fend off those feelings of emptiness.
Did you enjoy your experience in the theatre?
I loved it. You know, one of my early musical jobs was in the pit of a theatre playing a musical. In fact, the first decent wage I got £60 a week, was in the Newcastle Theatre playing in the pit for Joseph's Technicolor Dreamcoat by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. And I think it's their best work, actually. But I was under the stage with a little music stand and a light and my bass, and I'd watch the conductor and loved it. I could hear the actors clattering around above me. And I liked the sort of camp sense of humour and actors, and they're very, you know, vivacious, ebullient people, very, very confident. I never imagined that one day I'd be the boss of a theatre company making, you know, performing my own play. That was beyond the bounds of even my ambition, but that's what happened.
And have you got another one up your sleeve?
You know, I think it's an interesting thing for a songwriter to have to be in the discipline of the musical theatre. When you make an album track, an album song can exist in a sort of hermetic reality. It's itself. Whereas in a play, a song has to drive narrative forward, advance the narrative. You can't, for 3 minutes, just have a static emotion and then you wait for the song to finish before you can carry on with the story. No, the song has to perform the function of driving the narrative. So it has to be in a different place from when the song began. That's a fantastic discipline. Every line, every couplet, every verse can be cut at any time for the purpose of driving the story forward. It's quite cruel, but an amazing discipline.
It is, yeah. As a lyricist, I've been studying Sondheim in the last 5 years, and the way he drives the story forward with his lyrics is just extraordinary discipline.
He's remarkable, you know, and I met Stephen. You know, what I didn't realise as a kid was he wrote most of those lyrics for West Side Story. A lot of the music, too.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he has a school, I think, in New York for musical theatre.
Yeah, I should sign up.
So should I. So Help Musicians is a charity supporting musicians, and particularly in the last year during the pandemic, it's doled out over £17 million to songwriters who are on the ground and in dark places.
Yeah.
I've been lucky enough to work with some of them. The empathy and the love from people like that is extraordinary. Do you feel that there is empathy in the music industry?
I think, you know, we're all very competitive, particularly in Britain. But I think among songwriters, yes, I think there's an understanding of how difficult the job is and how wonderful it is when someone writes a brilliant song. You feel a little bit of jealousy, but also an admiration. I recently performed one of your songs.
I know, with Gary Barlow.
Because it's one of my favourite songs. I just love the way it's structured. I love the chords, going back between minor and major. It's a fantastic tune. So, you know, it's lovely to immerse yourself in someone else's work as a songwriter and appreciate it.
Mm. You know, for a charity to be dishing out that kind of money when record companies have got, and, you know, Spotify and companies like that. Do you think they could reach out a little bit more?
You know, when Napster first came out, the record companies declared war on that phenomenon. And they lost that war. And then they went to the negotiating table and they were offered, all of them were offered equity in these companies like Spotify, like Napster. But who was not at the table? It was the songwriters weren't at the table. And so we didn't get a cut. Now, I'm fortunate because I have maybe 100 songs out there that are earning shavings every day, and economies of scale mean that, you know, I can make a living from streaming. But if you only have one song and you're trying to pay the rent and, you know, put your kids in school and buy clothes, you can't do it. It's impossible. And so I think it's an increasingly good way to put music out there, to stream it, but the people who make it and create it need more. You know, I'm not speaking for myself. I'm fine. But for most songwriters struggling, it's tough.
It is tough. Some of the songwriters I've met have been in very strange places, but optimistic, I think. There's a lot of optimism.
Well, I've always said that music is its own reward. You know, you can sit at home with your cat and just play songs to the cat. You don't necessarily need stadiums full of people to enjoy music. So yes, they will be optimistic. At the same time, they deserve to be paid. Sure. They do a great service for society, songwriters.
So with the pandemic sort of leaning to one side and the possibility of getting back out on stage again, how does that make you feel?
A bit anxious. I haven't really been on stage in 18 months, so I hope I remember how to do it. Yeah, but I'm looking forward to getting back into my living room, which is what I call the stage. You know, I know where everything is. I know everybody there. I feel comfortable. So I'm dying for that to happen soon.
So it is kind of like home, being on the road.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I feel home in the terminal at Heathrow. It's been very unusual to spend, you know, more than two nights in the same bed, which is odd. But I've sort of got into it. And I've been very fortunate. You know, my garden is the size of Hyde Park. If I was in a high-rise with three kids and a goldfish, it would be an entirely different experience. So believe me, I appreciate the difference there.
I know. We're just about to go out on tour, and I can't find my suitcase. Yet normally, it's in the boot of my car.
The secret to that, Chris, is never unpack. I've still got my case packed. It drives my wife crazy. But I say, you know, I'm just transient here.
She's an amazing woman. She's somebody you've leant on for a long, long time. She's such a great support.
Well, she's a wonderful actor and a producer. And, you know, I also encourage her to do her craft, even when it means I miss her. But I wouldn't be happy with a little woman at home. You know, I want somebody out there fighting like I am.
Absolutely. Well, Sting, thank you so much for your time. I'm absolutely blessed that you're here today.
Oh, I'm thrilled, and I hope we can do something for our fellow songwriters and musicians. They deserve our support.
God bless.
Thanks, Chris. God bless you.
It was so generous of Sting to give us so much time. That was absolutely amazing. We seem to have so much in common. We shared the same management. We probably shared the same station wagon when we toured in America. We played the same venues, apart from Shea Stadium, of course. The one thing I don't have in common with Sting is having a garden the size of Hyde Park. Thanks for listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen with me, Chris Difford. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and please leave us a review, hopefully a good one. We'd love to know what you think and who you'd like us to feature in future shows. See you on the next episode and keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.